It's Thursday, December 27th, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Timothy Dennis.
Jacqueline Froelich.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Katie Henriksen.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. We're all together because we're talking about some of our favorite stories this week, as we've done the past couple of years, ever since we've gone to a daily show. And let's see. I asked all of you to pick up kind of your, to pick out some of your favorite stories, either ones you enjoyed putting together or how they sounded at the end, or you just thought should be heard again. And I'm going to start this time with Tim, because you came into my office, Timothy, and said, have you heard about this arcade? Mm-hmm. I thought an arcade. But what was in that arcade? What is in that arcade?
What is in that arcade are several dozen vintage arcade machines. Like anything from Asteroids to Sunset Riders to Donkey Kong to Pac-Man, you name it. I mean, they've even got a Frogger, like, cocktail sit-down arcade machine. And I mean,
one of my favorite things that came out in that story is the proprietor, when you talk to him, he said, you know, come in. The game may not be working. These are old things that have been in Pizza Huts, and they've been banged up a little bit. So,
but I mean, that's something you have to expect at an old-school arcade, is machines are going to be broken down.
Best part, and we'll hear this in the story, you just pay $5 at the door,
yeah,
and you play. You could be there till midnight or whenever it closes.
Exactly. I mean, you pay an admissions fee, and all of the machines are free play, which means they don't take coins. So whenever you die on the machines, like, you can just hit continue and keep going till you beat the game.
That was the definition of heaven for 7th grade Kyle Kellum. That was, let's hear a part of that.
Although coin-operated video games are not as prevalent as they were before the rise in popularity of the home video game console, vintage video game fanatics in Fayetteville will soon have a new haven in which to while away countless hours blasting at asteroids, jumping over barrels, and toppling turtles. That's one of the reasons why Fayetteville resident Shay Mathis decided to open Arcadia Retrocade, a new arcade with more than 50 vintage arcade games set to open in the coming days at the Evelyn Hills Shopping Center in Midtown Fayetteville.
What we're hoping to do is sort of create a little pocket alternate universe here, where when you walk through the front door of the Arcadia Retrocade, you're kind of like walking into an alternate universe where there was an arcade from 1982 that just never closed. There's something that one can experience when you're playing a video game, or it's kind of akin, and no offense to our readers and my former AP Lit teachers and stuff, but it's something along the lines of when you get lost in a really good book. There's a similarity in the experience of getting lost in fantasy, of getting lost in the experience of playing one of these games and being in a place where you could just forget all of your troubles, forget all the stuff that's going on in the outside world, and just have fun like you did when you were 12.
But this arcade is a little bit different than many other arcades. One machine that will not be found within the arcade's walls is a change machine. Mathis says that no quarters are necessary to play in this arcade.
Once you pay to enter the arcade, you pay for nothing else unless you want to buy a Coke or something from the snack bar. All of the game machines, in other words, are free play.
In addition to the many stand-up arcade machines that will line the walls of the Arcadia Retrocade, a raised platform in the center of the room will provide seating for the arcade snack bar, a handful of cocktail table arcade games, and an area for a monthly featured classic video game console. Mathis says that he hopes to create the feel of an arcade that opened in 1982 and never closed, and that the machines in his arcade have the patina to match it.
I like the fact that the games show their wear a little bit. That shows the character, that's part of the character of each game, the history of each game. You know, we have an old Pong. It's actually a Pong knockoff cocktail table game that came out of an old pizza parlor in the 70s. It's fun to imagine the history behind each one of these games. We like some of the games showing a little bit of their wear so that when you play this thing, you know that it has been through the ringer. It has been possibly all over the country and back just to get here to you, to have you play it and enjoy it now 20 years after the last time you plunked a quarter into it.
Mathis says that the games in the arcade come from a variety of sources. Some games were found after long hours of scouring Craigslist, while others were bought at auctions that included arcade machines, jukeboxes, toy cranes, and other machines generally found in restaurants and at the entrance of box stores. The games cost between $200 and $300 a piece on average, and though they may look a little rough on the outside, Mathis says that most of the games needed little work to get them up and running.
Simple cleaning, dusting, so cleaning the contacts, and just double checking to make sure there weren't stuff that wasn't connected properly. So with very little experience, I managed to get three or four of the games up and running just as soon as we got them home and off the truck that were not actually working when we bought them. You need to have a little bit of know-how on the technical end. And fortunately, I've got some buddies who have been playing around with this sort of thing for some time and have a little bit of experience and are also kind of learning as we go on some of the, certainly some of the older ones, you know. So yes, here and there you have to do a little soldering or a little this or a little that or a few magic tricks here and there.
And considering the age of the majority of games in the arcade, Mathis says that people shouldn't be surprised if they come in one day only to find that their favorite machine is out of order. The oldest game inside is more than 30 years old and is a verifiable classic.
This is Asteroids. Most people who were in arcades in the 80s will recognize Asteroids as one of the quote old school games, and this was made in 1979. It's a little faded, but it still plays as well as it did, you know, probably a year or two after it rolled off the factory floor.
Mathis says that Asteroids will occupy a special place in front of the arcade with all of the classic games, which will include other titles such as Pac-Man, Centipede, Donkey Kong, and the original Mario Brothers arcade game, which Mathis says he remembers playing as a child living in Fayetteville.
And this particular game, they used to have in one of the grocery stores here in town, and my friend and I were talking about it, trying to probe our memory banks to recall whether or not it was the IGA down on the corner of Lafayette and 71. And we're pretty sure, because when I would go spend the night and have a sleepover at his house, and invariably his mom would need to pull over and get some groceries or something, and she'd give us each a quarter and say, have at it, and then she'd go grocery shop, and we'd sit there on one quarter apiece and just burn an otherwise boring 7.5 minutes up.
And childhood dreams are what Mathis says is responsible for fueling his desire to open an arcade.
This or something like this is the kind of project, the kind of sort of quote dream job that I and a lot of my buddies as kids would have said we would love to do. Oh man, we could own our own arcade one day. It's the kind of thing that, you know, sitting around talking with your friends when you're 12 or 15, or even when you're, you know, in those murky college years trying to figure out why you're majoring and what you chose to major in, that sort of thing. You invariably get to that point of the night where you're having that discussion, you know, I just wish we could open up our own comic book store. I wish we could run an old art house theater and just play awesome movies and blah, blah, blah. That sort of discussion. This is the kind of thing we as friends have talked about for years and years.
He says that the thought occurred to him to open an arcade at a time when he was unemployed. While he says he could have worked for somebody else relatively comfortably, he was unsure whether he would be able to live with himself had he not taken the chance on opening his own business. And opening a vintage arcade doesn't come without its setbacks. Mathis says that while he planned to open in the middle of October, construction delays caused him to push back the grand opening numerous times.
I'll give you a very good example. The bathrooms that we needed to install, we have 100% full bathroom remodel back in the back. And when the original building was built, this particular wing of the building, they did not plumb for sewer all the way across the length of the building. So the plumbing stopped at a little tiny rinky-dink little employee bathroom. And so we literally had to get in and bust up about 35 feet of concrete to lay a trunk line, a sewer line, set in the concrete. And so I would definitely call it a complication. It's not something that our guys couldn't handle. They did a great job, and that actually didn't take even as long as I thought that would, but that was certainly a complication.
And aside from construction, Mathis says that the process of opening an arcade isn't for the faint of heart.
It's been crazy. It's been absolutely nuts and fun and everything, all of that stuff that you can imagine. It has been that. Lots of sleep deprivation, lots of budgeting and rebudgeting and rebudgeting.
While he says he has been putting in long hours trying to get the arcade ready for its opening, Mathis says opening the arcade couldn't have been possible without the help from a handful of family, friends, and other people who have lent their services to making his arcade dreams come true. The Arcadia Retrocade is set to open this week. For more information, Mathis suggests that interested parties should seek out the arcade's page on Facebook. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Sticking with the theme of fun, Jackie, you did a story this year about a proposed Eureka Springs. Well, not proposed. It's going to happen. This help
it is,
here.
But I'm still with the seventh grade Kyle Kellums from the earlier conversation. Yeah, Eureka Springs is going to be installing one of the, I think, the first music sculpture park in the state. And there's not very many in the country. I did another search on that and couldn't find any, but one, I think, in New York. And it's going to be by Renaga Fardabiaj, who is an amazing artisan. Of course, he is on the Guinness Book of World Records for building the largest wind chime in the world, musically tuned wind chime, south of Eureka Springs. If you haven't seen it, drive up and you can play it. It's there, it's hanging from a tree, it's free. But he went on to create another musical installation up at the prestigious Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. And he, but he spends most of his time at Renaissance fairs, selling his wares, primarily his tuned musical wind chimes. But he was commissioned by the city of Eureka Springs to install a musical sculpture park inside a really pretty pocket park on North Main that's been kind of, it's been landscaped, but it's really kind of quiet. And the things that he's going to install with the help of a collective of artisans, other artisans, is just going to be lovely. This is what North Main Street Park sounds like. But by next May, residents and visitors will hear these sounds. Renaga Fardabiaj walks along a stone pathway with one of his musically tuned wind chimes. It's a prototype of a much larger chime installation he will install here, which will play a certain iconic melody.
This is John Lennon's "All We Are Saying Is Give Peace a Chance." So the sculpture will be ringing out a message of peace constantly. Part of the interpretation will explain that if you strike the notes in a particular pattern, you will play "Give Peace a Chance." But whether you know that or not, it'll still be sounding a call for peace.
Wind chime artist Renaga Fardabiaj builds musically tuned wind chimes for a living. He markets them at Renaissance festivals and arts and crafts fairs across the country. Born in Germany in 1948 to Ignaz and Helen Fardabiaj, two Polish Holocaust survivors, Renaga learned fabrication from his father, an inventor and expert in electrical engineering. Renaga's Celestial Winds Harmonic Bazaar, his retail store and workshop, located on Highway 23 south of Eureka Springs, has become a popular tourist attraction because suspended from a large oak tree out front hangs the world's largest musically tuned wind chime. That's according to the Guinness Book of World Records. But Renaga's most noted sound installation to date was staged at the prestigious Walker Arts Center in Minneapolis several years ago. It's a fabrication commissioned for French artist Pierre Huyghig for the exhibition The Quick and the Dead in the center's sculpture garden.
In 2009, I was commissioned to do a sound piece for the Walker Art Institute in Minneapolis by a French artist. It was a deconstruction of a John Cage score called Dream. We took the score for Dream, which was originally commissioned by the Martha Graham Dance Company, and deconstructed the piece into 49 individual wind chimes that were tuned to every single note that John Cage wrote. These are hanging in a grove of trees next to the Spoonbridge and Cherry at the Walker Arts Center in the Sculpture Garden.
Spoonbridge and Cherry, an immense outdoor sculpture created by American artist Klaus Oldenburg. And for Eureka's North Main Street Park, Renaga is designing three individual sound sculptures.
One will be a large marimba-like structure. One will be a chime tree-like, a serpentine chime tree piece that'll actually play a section of recognizable music. Will be 20 feet long, and it'll be serpentine that you'll be able to tap the pieces individually to get the musical sounds, or you'll be able to, I can see children, you know, just running under this thing, kind of joyfully dancing under the pieces and playing it that way.
and the Serpentine Chime Tree will be made up of 10 groups of chimes, each tube 1/4 inch in width and 8 to 18 inches in length, depending upon the tone.
The Ozarkophone will be wooden slats tuned in a pentatonic scale, and they'll have a sound similar to this.
The third will be made of huge metal tubes partially buried in the earth.
The Stonehenge-like metallophone and the wooden Ozarkophone, I call it, which will be made out of cedar and walnut planking, will both be tuned in a pentatonic scale, which is similar to the black keys on a piano. For anyone who's ever sat down at a piano and just pounded on the black keys, you can't hit a bad note. So if you want to impress your friends, if you just play the black keys on a piano, if you have any kind of rhythm or timing, you'll be able to play a tune. I also recently learned that most gospel tunes are written in pentatonic scales. So the metallophone will have a sound similar to this.
Patrons understand and play the musical sculpture, interpretation will be installed as well. Other artists will also be pitching into this project.
I've been chosen as the project designer and chief sound designer for the Eureka Springs Sound Park, but we'll be collaborating with other Eureka Springs artists in the creation of the sculptural elements to make it a true collaborative project.
The planned sculpture garden is located in one of the most neglected sections of Eureka, dotted with abandoned limestone facades and a few rundown homes. But things are slowly improving. This wooded parcel of land, originally gifted to the city by William and Carolyn Bomberger in 1991, has served as a free parking area for residents who work downtown and as a trolley stop for visitors. In recent years, the city transformed 2/3 of the lot, creating gardens and building walkways, picnic tables, and benches. A public restroom is planned, along with a visitor's kiosk. A new sidewalk connects the park to the shopping district several blocks south. Leatherwood Creek flows to the north just across the street, and Old Depot Spring is located nearby. Members of the Eureka Springs Downtown Network are now responsible for the gardens. But Sandy Martin, chair of the Eureka Springs Arts Council, is responsible for coming up with the idea of transforming this site into a musical sound sculpture park.
We wanted to, at the Eureka Springs Arts Council, we wanted to beautify different locations throughout the city, particularly the points of entry in the city. And North Main was one that was just begging for something. This park was here. It's a beautiful park. It has free parking. It's a nice gateway and a nice showcase going in and out of the city. So we thought this would be a terrific area to do it. Plus, we want to revitalize all of the North Main area. We're getting so jam-packed downtown and so many activities at Basin Park that this also provides another venue for activities, events, concerts, and the musical sculpture park just fit in beautifully.
This summer, the local arts council learned it would receive a substantial grant to start up the project.
We were able to get a grant with the great help of Glenna Booth at the city. We collaborated with the city and the community development project of Western Carroll County. And we applied for a grant through the Arkansas Arts Council and received $6,400 to get us started on this grant. And they loved the idea. We took some sketches that Renaga had done. They said it was unique and fresh and were real interested in following the project.
Because this district is zoned both commercial and residential, a community meeting was held to inform neighbors about the endeavor, who have all signed on. Outdoor sculpture parks are commonplace across Europe, and we have around 30 of them in North America. Musical sculpture parks, however, are rare. The city of Montreal in Quebec recently constructed Harmony Park. It features tuned drums, marimba, and chimes, all fixed and bolted into aggregate concrete walkways. It's a little sterile looking. Eureka's musical sculpture park, however, will be much more organic, blending in with the forested mountain setting. Renaga Farbiage will spend the winter building the three musical sculptures in anticipation of a spring unveiling. Eureka Springs Arts Council Chair Sandy Martin.
Renaga will start working, has started working on the instruments already, and we're going to unveil it during the 2013 May Festival of the Arts. So it'll probably be right around the beginning of the festival for the kickoff of it, and we're planning some events. We want a lot of kids down here to participate in sound and music and outdoor venue as well. So that's when we're going to kick it off.
And hopefully by next spring, the little unnamed park, blooming with jonquils, forsythia, and sound, will also be christened and named. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. We're talking about some of our favorite stories. We'll move now from a musical future to a musical past. You talked, Katie Hendrickson, you talked to Jim Greeson about the documentary he did about Colin Nancarrow. And this is kind of a forgotten figure, born in Texarkana, but it's a wonderful story.
Yeah, Colin Nancarrow was a composer who did compositions that were admired by people like John Cage, but he grew up in Texarkana, Arkansas. What's really fascinating about Nancarrow is that he actually was composing for ensembles, but found that really frustrating. So he ended up doing these player piano compositions where he actually, it's like the player pianos that were automated and you poke holes to make the piano play itself. And he poked his own holes in these. He was so frustrated with the way ensembles were performing his music that he made his own player piano compositions because they were so complex rhythmically and dynamically. Well, not really dynamically. A player piano doesn't really do much with dynamics, but rhythmically they were so complex that a machine could play them better than a person could play them because there were so many things going on with time signatures and how fast the notes were being played and all sorts of things. Professor Greeson has recently done a documentary about Nancarrow, and he won a MacArthur Genius Grant. He lived a lot of his life in Mexico, actually. But he's a fascinating figure in music, and he's from Arkansas, and not that many people really even know about him.
Well, here's part of that conversation and that story that you did with Jim Greeson about the documentary.
I somehow got the crazy notion that I could produce a documentary film. And part of that came out of the idea that I had had this idea for a subject. Back some years ago, I became infatuated with Conlon Nancarrow's music. When I was finishing high school, this was like 1969 in St. Louis, a friend of mine got a sort of a sampler record from Columbia Record Company, this little floppy plastic square thing that you put on top of another record on a turntable, and you could listen to little samples of different other projects that Columbia Records was trying to sell to you and interest you in. And even though it was a rock record that my friend bought, he was a guy, we played in a band, and he was the organ player, and I was the guitar player, and he said, let's check out what's on this little sampler. And he put it on, and crazily enough, Columbia sent out this sampler that contained a Conlon Nancarrow player piano piece. In fact, it was this famous Canon X, or Study 21. And I was just in high school. I was playing rock guitar. I sang in the choir at school, but I mean, I didn't have some, this was like, we heard that piece, and it just blew my mind. I mean, almost literally. I felt like that guy in the, I think it was Bang & Olufsen commercials, where you used to see the guy sitting in the recliner, and his hair was shooting straight back because the sound was just flooring him. And it was just like that. And I had no idea what was going on, but it impressed me a lot. And I never forgot the name. And then I went off to college and studied music and ended up getting a doctorate and all that. But I never forgot that initial encounter with Nancarrow. And then happily, I got this job teaching here in Fayetteville, and Dr. Barbara Jackson, who shared an office, or didn't share an office, we were colleagues in the department, and she knew I was a composer, and I was interested in trying to promote work of Arkansas composers, just because I had become one, and I thought that let's do that. And Barbara pointed out to me one day, she said, you know Conlon Nancarrow's from Arkansas. And I said, no, I did not know that. And of course he is. He's from Texarkana. He was born and raised in Texarkana, Arkansas.
Documentary talks about his frustration with performers performing his work, and that kind of drew him into the player piano compositions. So I'm wondering if that has something to do with, like, why part of why he might not be as well known as he should be.
Without a doubt. I mean, most composers get known by orchestras or string quartets or someone performing his music, and it's literally a word of mouth sort of thing. Like if a string quartet, and he did write some string quartets in his one at least around 1940, and it got played some, but not much. And so since he ended up writing, and he just as you say, he wrote music for player piano because he grew very frustrated with live performers kind of botching his music. And he also wanted to take it he wanted his music to transcend what live performers could ever play, at least as far as we can tell yet. Basically, his music is about having different speeds of music going along at the same time, different tempos. And it wasn't, and there's some music you can find where you might have 2 against 3. That's not uncommon. But then higher ratios get harder and harder to pull off. 3 against 4, one will encounter sometimes, even 5 against 4 or 5 against 3. But ratios that get kind of smaller than that are pretty much impossible for live musicians to work with to play. And that was the sort of thing he was interested in. And just all sorts of hyper-subtle sort of tempo variations where one part is going maybe at 120 beats per minute and the other part's going 123 beats per minute. They just subtle little things. And that fascinated him. And in fact, he invented kind of a whole musical language that worked with that. And that's what he's admired for. In fact, many composers, younger composers, view him as like the first computer music composer, which is a very reasonable point of view. Even though a player piano is not a computer, it's not that different from one, with the piano roll serving sort of the point of like an early punch card in some of those early huge IBM computers or UNIVAC computers you'd see. And so the player piano, the roll itself is like a program, in a sense, going through, and the machine, the player piano, interprets that and plays it rhythmically. And so he could, especially after he adapted his punching machine, and he didn't send these off to be punched. I mean, he would dream up this music, and he came up with a way to kind of lay it out so that he could have these subtle tempo relationships. And then he punched every hole by himself. He said it took him usually a year to finish one piece, and some longer than that. Some of them had, and he wasn't a minimalist composer in any stretch. I mean, if you listen to any of his music, there are notes flying everywhere. So he was a really notey sort of composer, and he had to punch every one of those notes by hand with this hole punching machine he developed. But he got it adjusted at one point, probably in the late 1950s, so he could put a note anywhere on the roll that he wanted, and thereby have just absolutely any imaginable tempo relationship, which wasn't possible before, and really hasn't been possible until the last maybe dozen years when computer software has come to that point. So he was in many ways the first computer composer. The big difference there is that it wasn't a computer, it wasn't some sort of sample or synthesizer playing the music. It was a very real-sounding piano playing it. And as everyone has said, in fact, the documentary starts off with these people talking about what an impact hearing his music played in his studio had. It's kind of shocking. I mean, it's just so loud and incisive and dramatic. It's completely different from like putting on headphones from an iPhone or something and listening to a tune. It's just very visceral. And it's like the sound waves are literally right there outside your body, just kind of making you quiver a little bit as you're hearing it.
This is Ozarks at Large. Music plays a big part in our show. And now that we have the Furman Garner Performance Studio, where we're sitting for this series of programs, we can bring artists in. But occasionally, if it's just one or two people and someone's already in the Furman Garner, you can just have them in our own personal studios. And Jonathan Trawick, who's a fiddler extraordinaire, popped in one day just kind of and said, hey, my buddy here that we're playing music, do you have time for us? Could we talk and play a couple tunes? I said, sure. And they ended up playing a song that they had just written the night before, so the world premiere, and here's part of that. What are you going to do? Do you know?
Well, what do you want to play? You want to play a little Dixon Street Breakdown?
Sure.
This is a tune he wrote the other night.
On Dixon Street.
Hey, that's great. You wrote that just the other night?
Mm-hmm.
Cody Marriott on violin, Jonathan Trawick on guitar. That is worth a couple of dollars in the case, don't you agree?
I would think so.
Come back anytime.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Kyle. Thanks, Travis.
This is Ozarks at Large, some of our favorite stories, the subject of today and all this week. Sometimes our stories have lives that we don't expect. Now with social media, they can get shared on Twitter or Facebook. But Antoinette, you did a story this year, and this is an interesting story of how you decided, how you found out about it, how you did it, and what happened afterward. It was about renters' rights.
Yeah, this is different. I had a young woman contact me, a graduate student at the University of Arkansas, with her story about she lived in Maple Street Apartments, and they were basically getting kicked out because the property had been sold, and it was going to get knocked down, and they were going to build a bigger complex. And they were given, I don't know, like 45 days or something like that. But part of her argument was why they were not involved, they being the residents, weren't more involved in the decision for this. And she had found out that it's a project that had been in the works for a while. And with many of them being university students, why weren't they told ahead of time so they could have moved out over winter break instead of the middle of the semester? Because it was like in February or March. It was a very odd kind of date. And so the problem with this story is I didn't know where to start, because as a person, I felt really bad and wanted to help. But as a journalist, it's like where, you know, you have to be professional.
So. And you've got to find the nut of the story, too.
Exactly. And you have to find the point of the story. So I talked to you about it for a long time. Mm-hmm. And we brought her in. We talked to her for a while. And that led me to ask, you know, what rights do renters actually have? And we happened to find someone who could help us out, a lawyer, I believe, who came in and started talking about it. And it was upsetting because the answer is basically nothing.
Arkansas is ranked like 49th when it comes to renters' rights.
They had hardly any, and that was upsetting. And then after the story aired, you told me a professor on campus actually used it in her class because it was informative. So that was interesting how it just took on a life of its own, because it was interesting for me because I learned something, but also the fact that it was able to teach other people something was kind of cool.
How does that make you feel when you think about there are students in a classroom and they're hearing your story?
A little itchy. Okay. I just I still find that a weird concept that I'm a professional worker and I do things that people might actually listen to and might actually help them. Like, that's very strange to me.
Well, let's say you're part of that story.
In Arkansas, far less than anywhere in the country, we are the most tenant unfriendly place in the country.
Marshall Prettyman is the director of litigation for Legal Aid of Arkansas. He has a few examples of how the state is, as he puts it, tenant unfriendly.
One, we are the only state where it's a crime not to pay your rent. We have a statute that you can actually be jailed for not paying your rent. We are the only state that has not, in some form, passed what's called a warranty of habitability. A warranty of habitability is a principle that the landlord has to maintain premises up to at least basic levels. All right. I wrote an article a couple of years ago, and at that time pointed out how Alabama, the year before, had, with some pomp and circumstance, passed a warranty of habitability so they would not be one of only two states that didn't have it, which left you know who, Arkansas. So, and then, about 5 years ago, at common law, landlord had almost no responsibility for conditions on the premises, even in the common areas, all right? And most states have been expanding that liability. So just to give you an example, you go up the stairs and the landlord hasn't kept them in repair and somebody falls through the stairs and breaks their legs or in some way seriously hurts themselves. In almost every state, you could sue the landlord in tort. Not in Arkansas. All right. Arkansas not only took the common law limitations, but strengthened them at a time when everybody else was weakening.
A landlord may be responsible for repairs if such a provision has been written into the lease. These contracts can be dozens of pages long, and while Prettyman says ideally tenants should have it looked at by an attorney, most renters don't have the money or access to a lawyer.
When I wrote my article, which was supposed to be out of new landlord-tenant statute we passed, I named the article Landlord Protection Law on the theory that's what we have here. And that's actually another illustration, because what they passed the statute, it was now be about 4 years ago, that ostensibly was there's this group called that passes these uniform acts that states pass, right? And they passed a Uniform Landlord-Tenant Act. Arkansas slipped through this act, I think on the pretense that it was the Uniform Act. However, they had eliminated absolutely every provision that favored tenants, including some that shouldn't have even been controversial. Things like they put in a provision that the landlord can't have something that's unconscionable in the lease contract. Well, Arkansas, in regular contracts under the Uniform Commercial Code, has a provision on unconscionability, that you can't have unconscionable, and defines what it is. What was in the act was verbatim what we already have in regular contract law, but they wouldn't apply it to leases. They took it out. That's how outrageous. I mean, to the point that one of the other things they had in there was if tenant rents a place and the landlord doesn't deliver the property, the tenant can get out of the lease. It sort of seems to me that should be a no-brainer. And it was in the Model Act. They took it out.
And why were these items removed from the Act? Prettyman has a theory.
My theory is that the landlords have very strong lobbies in the legislature. And unlike most states, tenants in this state have no lobby. And I'll further postulate that that's because we don't have a significant middle class or upper class tenant population. If you think about it, Arkansas, most of our tenants are either poor or students. And they are not groups that are active with legislators. And, you know, coming from New Jersey, there are an awful lot of middle class people and indeed wealthy people that rent. And not surprisingly, New Jersey has a very strong state tenants organization that goes and lobbies for the tenants. And that's how you get laws that favor the tenants. There is no countervailing organization here to lobby on behalf of tenants.
Despite all of this, Arkansas tenants do have some rights. Prettyman says, for example, if you are paying a month-to-month rent, the landlord is not required to have a reason to terminate tenancy. However, the landlord is required to give 30 days notice, assuming there is nothing specific stating otherwise in the lease. A big issue that has come up recently is the federal government has passed a statute to deal with the foreclosure crisis vis-a-vis tenants. Prettyman says the statute is something a lot of people aren't familiar with.
Under the federal law, if bank forecloses, they now have the property. They want to get the tenants out. If there's a lease, they have to honor the lease through the end of the lease term. If there's no lease, if it's just a month-to-month tenancy, they still have to give a 90-day notice. Now, tenant would have to pay the rent for the 90 days, but they at least get a 90-day notice. The one exception on that, when I talked about the lease term, so say you have a one-year lease and 2 months in, the place gets foreclosed. If the bank buys it back, then you get to stay for the rest of the year. If someone buys it with the idea that they want to occupy, they don't have to honor the lease, but they do have to give you a 90-day notice. So that there is some protection there. Significantly, it didn't come from Arkansas law. It came from a federal statute.
Prettyman says one of the few rights Arkansas tenants have is landlords cannot use self-help. In other words, they can't just lock a tenant out of their residence.
If the landlord wants to get the tenant out, they have to go to court. Unless, of course, the tenant agrees to leave. But, I mean, to try to force a tenant out. In spite of that, landlords do just come and put locks on the doors. So that's one issue that comes up quite a bit. Especially because typically if they put a lock on the door, all the tenant stuff is inside and the tenant obviously has serious problems. One of the other issues, and it's sort of tied to that, the first step in bringing in an eviction action in Arkansas is the landlord has to send the tenant what's called a notice to cease, notice to quit. All right, and that notice to cease, notice to quit, if it's non-payment for rent, says you've got to be out in 3 days. All right. We always get these calls, I can't get out in 3 days. Well, the reality is you don't have to get out in 3 days. The reality is that's the first step in the process. If you're not out in that three-day period, then the landlord can bring the action to put you out. But you can't be put out until the landlord brings the action. You either don't respond and it goes as a default, or you respond and it goes to a judge who says, yes, you're going to be put out. And once again, the landlord doesn't put you out. Once the court says the landlord has the right, it goes to a sheriff's officer. The sheriff's officer is the one who comes and affects the lockout.
For more information, visit the Arkansas Attorney General's website at ag.arkansas.gov and search landlord tenant law.
This is Ozarks Large. We're talking today and all this week about some of our favorite stories. Christina Thomas, who made about 7 different lists because she would alter it and say, no, I want this one, I want this one. The list that you gave me just had one word on it, cafeteria.
Right, cafeteria. I worked on a farm to school series over the summer, and this is just one of the stories. It's not shocking to hear that America is one of the fattest countries, and you know, lack of information about nutrition, and you know, cheap food is not necessarily good food. And the USDA, I believe all of these rules and regulations go into effect, I think, in January of 2013. They've changed the rules of what schools can feed the children in the cafeteria. But they're not giving the public schools any more money. And so Adam Simmons, who's a food service director with Fayetteville Public Schools, has something like a dollar, you know, for each meal to feed these kids, which isn't much. And a group of professors at the University of Arkansas wrote a grant to help get fresh farm, you know, local farm food into the public school system. And so this summer they had to start small with the summer feeding program. And anyways, I thought it would be interesting to go see how the food arrives at the cafeteria and then what the cafeteria workers do, because it's different. You know, they don't know what to do with fresh tomatoes and cucumbers, because what they're used to feeding the kids are chicken strips and right. pizza. So, you know, I just kind of wanted to see how this affects how they do their jobs.
Cars pull up behind Owl Creek School on a warm and sunny Monday morning. Children hop out, some escorted by parents. They run into the building. Then a large white van pulls up, but there are no kids inside. Vicky with NWA Natural Produce is hauling vegetables to feed these children.
What do you have today?
I have bell pepper and tomato, cherry, and okra.
Awesome.
Yes.
Sammy Jones is the Energy Corps member with Fayetteville Public Schools. She's there this morning to meet Vicky, to help weigh her produce, and to make sure she gets paid. Sammy acts as a liaison between Fayetteville Public Schools and the farmers. They unload large gray plastic tubs filled with the produce. Once inside the cafeteria kitchen, Sammy helps to weigh the foods, carefully writing down the amounts. The price per pound is already set, and they have a general idea what they can pay per serving. Using a tool developed by Oklahoma's Farm to School program, Sammy calculates how much Vicky is owed.
You just type in the number of servings that you know you're going to have, and they have two different serving sizes, and then it tells you the number of pounds you need for, you know, that number of servings or that serving size, and then you can type in the price per pound, and it'll give you a price per serving size. So we're aiming for about 40 cents per servings of vegetables and fruit. So that, you know, we can look at like, okay, well, like the cherry tomatoes are a little more expensive, but we can weigh that out with something that's a little bit cheaper. So that tool has been, like I use it on a daily basis looking at this stuff. It's really useful. So.
It takes a little bit to pay the farmers. The invoice has to go through the food services office and onto the business office. This is one of the drawbacks of participating in farm-to-school programs for the farmers. Though schools can and will pay their bills, it takes a while, and a lot of farmers are used to being paid immediately, like at a farmer's market.
Got it. So there's 4 or 5.5 pounds. Yeah.
Also inside the cafeteria, helping to weigh the veggies, is Tina Bolin, Owl Creek cafeteria manager. She takes us through what she plans to do with the foods brought in today.
This we put out fresh a lot because the kids like cucumbers fresh. I doubt we pickle any of them because they eat them so well fresh. These, they're eating them really well fresh too. And actually I have some portioned. We'll go look at them.
She's talking about the cherry tomatoes, portioned with about 8 in a plastic cup. some things the kids have trouble grabbing. Putting them in cups makes the tomatoes easier to grab and go. They offer foods to the kids rather than serve them. Tina says that they are choosing the fresh fruits and veggies, but she is also around to answer any questions the kids may have.
Yeah, and if I hear a comment like, oh, what is this? You know, I always make sure I take time to go explain to the child what that is, because I've heard them before. What is cantaloupe? You know, what is cantaloupe? All kids should know what cantaloupe is. Every mother or, you know, every parent should have fed their child cantaloupe by now, you know.
Cantaloupe, a melon with orange-colored flesh. Tina continues explaining what she's going to do with the rest of today's delivery.
Bell peppers, we cook those in things like Sloppy Joe's, and we probably don't have that on the summer menu, but we'll put a lot of it out fresh. So a lot of this stuff we're adding out is just a bunch of fresh stuff that, you know, that the kids don't get introduced to as a lunchtime menu, you know. And then like the green beans are on the menu today. We're steaming those with a little bit of onions, a little dash of salt in there. Because a lot of our children hear Arabic, so we don't add hand base. So we add just a little touch of salt, because when you take salt out, you have to add salt back. And then we're going to do the pickled okra. We're going to try that like a refrigerator pickle. Instead of canning it in jars, we're going to steam bath it and all that, and then get it cooled off and get it in the refrigerator, and then it'll be just like a cold pickled okra. This will slice out for hamburgers and all kinds of sandwiches that we do in the summer program.
This is the first year that Tina has been in charge of the summer feeding program, a program that feeds kids in various summer camps, but is also open to the public. Any child can come here and eat for free. It is also the first year for farm to school. Tina would like to better pair food in the future, rather than serving pickled okra with, say, a corn dog. But it will take more planning. She has to follow the menus the district manager sets. Right now, what they do is add a fruit and a veggie to the menu that you see printed in the newspaper.
This is all extra on top of the menu. So we already base our requirements on what we feed them already, their meats, their breads, their fruits, their vegetables. This is giving them a bigger, broad spectrum of fresh fruits and vegetables that we can't normally afford, you know. So instead of peaches and apples and bananas all the time, they're getting blackberries and, you know, squash and cherry tomatoes and things that cost a lot of money. So.
As she stands there, sweat forming on her brow, she agrees that it is extra work, but work she doesn't mind doing.
I'm a farm girl, so I like to feed the kids good stuff, you know, and I don't like to see all this pre-prepared food. That's what I call it, pre-prepared food. It's like my pizza, corn dogs and stuff, you know. Get away from that, get them a little more real food in here that it's good home cooking, you know.
We've got one more day. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about some more of our favorite stories. Thank you all.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.